This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. While statistics about overdose deaths from the opioid epidemic continue to dominate headlines, other debilitating and costly problems have been creeping up in the shadows. As part of a special series, Opioid Crisis, The Ripple Effect, Kay Colby tells us about an increase in deadly heart infections among IV drug users. A little-known problem with big-time consequences for individual patients and society as a whole.
Vigorously scrubbing his hands and lower arms, Cleveland Clinic heart surgeon Jose Navia preps for the case ahead.
It's a very difficult case. Hopefully we can do in the right way. And then we like to replace the valve of the aortic valve and then repair the mitral valve.
Good suction to me.
In the OR, Navia quickly gets to work on his patient. A 31-year-old mother with two leaky heart valves due to an infection stemming from IV drug use. The condition is called infective endocarditis, and experts say it's on the rise among younger adults, mostly due to heroin use. A dirty needle or contaminated drug allows bacteria like staph to travel into the bloodstream and then attach to the valves.
And so the valve is literally being eaten alive by the bacteria.
Dr. Steven Nissen is head of cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. He says chunks of bacteria can also travel to the brain and cause strokes. Some patients have multiple complications and die.
Which room is that?
Standing among the beeps and hums of all the machinery in the cardiac ICU, Nissen reflects on how many of these younger patients are ending up here. The Cleveland Clinic says in 2014, 10% of its endocarditis patients undergoing surgery were addicted to opioids. In the first half of 2017, it was up to 18.5%. Research elsewhere shows similar trends.
Green towel, please.
Back in the OR, Dr. Navia finds all three flaps of his patient's aortic valve resemble tiny pieces of Swiss cheese.
Okay, this is another perforation. Shouldn't be this way. Should be completely close here.
Navia goes to work replacing the destroyed valve. The cost of these surgeries can run over $100,000, and many patients are on Medicaid or lack health insurance. Experts say patients who are IV drug users face a higher chance of multiple operations due to reinfection because they go back to using. A study at two large Boston hospitals found poor long-term results for endocarditis patients who use IV drugs, according to Dr. Torof Sunt, chair of cardiac surgery at Boston Massachusetts General.
93% of patients who used intravenous drugs by the 10-year mark had suffered either death, reinfection, or reoperation.
Bioethicist Mark Alessio from the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine says such cases raise some thorny ethical issues. He and others argue that addiction treatment needs to be part of the heart care protocol.
There's really got to be comprehensive care for patients who have this issue, because if there's not, you're going to put them through a lot of pain, some suffering, a difficult road for little, and in some cases, maybe no benefit.
Dr. Sunt agrees.
Yeah, I think that's one of the debates that you'll see on the national scene is the question of how many times can we redo these heart valve procedures, again, when we're not really adequately treating the underlying condition, which is the addiction. Our money would be much more wisely spent trying to help to cure the underlying problem, which is the addiction, rather than allowing the infections to recur.
Sun says Mass General is in the process of implementing addiction treatment for its endocarditis patients who use IV drugs. The Cleveland Clinic says it's initiated a program to include addiction treatment up front for such patients, and that other hospitals are looking at this as well.
I'll be with you.
It's early afternoon as Dr. Navia wraps up his case.
So the heart is managed by his own, and the two valves working fantastic.
While this surgery succeeded, the societal issues cases like this raise continue. Nissen says they exact a high toll in terms of human suffering as well as dollars and cents.
The legacy of this is going to go on for decades. It's a ripple effect and it keeps on growing.
Kay Colby, 90.3.
Researchers at Duke University are investigating how renewable energy sources like wind or solar might affect people in traditionally coal-dependent communities. Duke professor John Free is overseeing the project called Coal in America, Stories from the Central Appalachian Coal Fields. He and a group of undergraduate students will be interviewing folks throughout Appalachia. Jessica Lilly spoke with him to find out more.
So tell us about the project.
As you know, lots of people seem to think that they know what's been going on with coal mining. And because of that, they think that they know what the answers are for the future. But we're coming at this from the perspective both of that the stories and the histories that folks have lived are important to preserve for the future, and also are the best way of understanding what that history has been and what it means for the future.
And who might be a good fit for this to tell stories? Is it just coal miners, or is it people in the community who lived in these towns, you know, coal miner's daughter, wife, things like that? Who would be a good fit for this?
Number one on the list are folks with direct experience working in coal, but definitely those daughters, sons, wives, grandchildren who want to share their stories about their experiences with the coal industry. We want to hear those stories too, because they are also important to that whole history.
Yeah, and this is part of an energy initiative at Duke University. What's the goal of that initiative at Duke?
The Energy Initiative is a interdisciplinary effort on campus with the goal of securing a affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system.
Explain the connection between these oral histories that you're collecting from people in Central Appalachia and how that research might help to build the sustainable economy or whatever that you were talking about as far as Duke's, the Energy Initiative's goal. What's that connection?
Yeah, so a lot of the work that we support and do through the Energy Initiative is in the energy sciences. You know, figuring out new ways of using fuels or exploring new ways of producing energy or understanding the different ways that people use it and kind of planning for the future. And as a historian, I'm coming at it from the standpoint of not only that the past matters significantly to how we plan for the future, but also that, you know, while we're thinking about developing solar energy or other renewable sources of energy, that we're thinking about the people and the impacts on people's lives that these changes have had, continue to have, and will have in the future.
What's your connection to these histories in this region? Why'd you decide to come to Central Appalachia?
Yeah, well, it's a, you know, like a lot of historians, I have a long and winding road to my research topic, but I grew up in Western Kentucky, so a different area for coal mining, but over, I grew up on the Green River, which John Prine made famous in Paradise, where he talked about Mr. Peabody's coal train hauling away Muhlenberg County, which was neighbors, the county I grew up in, McLean County. So I went to college and graduate school at the University of Louisville, where I became interested in environmental history. And just following that interest and the sources led me to become really, really interested in the history, not just of coal, but specifically in the histories of the people who have mined coal over time. Also, I'm married to a woman who's from Corbin, Kentucky, which is kind of right there on the foothills of Appalachia, and her family has a long history of working in the industry. And my father-in-law is one of my favorite people to talk to about the research that I do, and he's always going out to the old family farm and bringing back relics. Like one year for Christmas, he handed me a paper bag, and there was a huge lump of coal in it that he had found on his parents' property.
How will you go about this process?
We'll be in the area for a couple of weeks in the coming months, and it's really going to depend on the individuals, like how we would go about collecting the interviews. Some folks, we imagine, will come and visit them in their homes with a couple of students come by with a recorder and sit down for an hour or two to just talk about their lives, like what it was like growing up, what they remember about Cole, what kinds of work they did, or what they remember about what their parents or family members did, and how things have changed over time. And then those interviews will all be deposited in an archive. Those participants will also get a copy of the interview, so you know they can keep it with them and keep it in their family. And so it'll be a record of their life story.
That was Duke University Professor John Free speaking with reporter Jessica Lilly about an oral history project called Coal in America, Stories from the Central Appalachian Coal Fields. To find out how to share your story, go to our website, wvpublic.org. Our Mountain Stage Song of the Week comes from jazz and pop vocalist Kat Edmondson, who makes her third appearance on the show with songs from her new album, Old Fashioned Gal. Accompanied by her band, here's Edmondson performing I'd Be a Fool.
How do you put the past away? How does the night forget about the day? So many things I want to say, but how do I get through? If you ever still think of me, if time has not erased my memory, would you accept an apology? So long overdue. I'd be a fool if for one second I thought you had been untrue. And then I told you we were through, and I no longer wanted you. I'd be a fool if I decided that what I needed to do was to go and hurt you too. That would be cruel.
That would be cruel.
And if you begged me not to go and told me that you love me so, I would be foolish not to turn around.
Kat Edmondson performing I'd Be a Fool live on Mountain Stage. For this and more, tune in tonight and tomorrow nights at 8 right here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Molly Bourne, Jessica Lilly, Kara Lofton, Liz McCormick, Dave Mistich, Brittany Patterson, and Roxy Todd. Our news director is Jesse Wright. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.